What happens when the sentimental barbarians push you into a corner and there's no place to go? And you look up and you don't agree with them. And if you don't agree with them, you're a racist. You're a monster. You're terrible. You're greedy. What do you do? We'll talk about that with Dan Proft, conservative talk show host. And we'll talk also to Jason Meisner, Chicago Tribune's federal building reporter, on a fascinating, complicated web of intrigue. Think of Homeland, you know, that show with the yarn and pictures and paranoid Carrie. But it's not paranoid Carrie, it's me. And I'm not paranoid because you know why? I know what I'm doing, and so does Jason. And something's happening in Chicago right under the surface, big time, with the boss of the Teamsters cooperating, and politicians running for cover. We haven't heard the last of it, and we're just about hearing the first of it. Panic is everywhere. Joining me again, as always, is Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis and WGN. And me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, conservative, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board as long as I can. And you know where you are? Standing there with the woke scold mob and the sentimental barbarians screaming at you in the night and the wise guys and the politicians on the other side making deals and taking your state grant money and having a great old time with it. You're on the Chicago way. On WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
We are speaking to Dan Proft, conservative activist and host of the great talk show, The Morning Answer, on WIND AM 560 with his colleague Amy Jacobson. Before we talk about the Democrats putting us all on the road to serfdom and Hayek's birthday, etc., how's Amy's son? That's what we have to ask you first.
She said so on the air, so thank you for asking. But he's doing well. For those who don't know, he had a brain tumor that was operated on. Came back benign, and he's, you know, young man. Transitioning from grade school to high school after next year. Thankfully, kids are resilient, and he's a resilient kid, and he's doing very well. So thank you for asking.
And it's nice, too, to have a guy like Dan as his, like, kind of an uncle. Like, you probably slip him silver dollars when you see him, right, when you see the kids.
I slip him copies of Friedman's greatest works, yes.
What do you give them to tell them to burn? Do you have any books to for them to burn?
Maybe I don't burn books. No.
Oh, that's right. That's not us. We're not the burn. Does. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Go reread your Ray Bradbury. We're not the Fahrenheit 451 crew.
Isn't that odd that the book burning thing was presented in those days as a meme or, you know, whatever of the right, but it really is of the left. The book burning, right. The censorship, the terrifying, you know, the woke scolds that terrify editors and columnists, not some, not all, and media people. Everyone's scared to offend.
Well, Jonah Goldberg wrote a book called Liberal Fascism to make that very point that others have made throughout the annals of history, that fascism and all sorts of statism, all sorts of subjugation by some of others emanate from the left. And so does the curtailing of opinion on college campuses and other public arenas. I mean, these are all products of cultural Marxism.
Now that we're into the left uses force to exert its will upon us, what did you think of the road to serfdom debates of the Democrats now that they're over?
Well, look, I mean, I think that there's a real key takeaway that Trump and Republicans should use to frame the 2020 election, which is, look, they all believe, with perhaps the exception of John Delaney and, you know, maybe kind of sort of Steve Bullock from Montana and maybe kind of sort of Tim Ryan from Ohio, but just kind of sort of the candidates that have a stone's chance of being the nominee for the Democrat Socialist Party are more the latter than they are the former. They're socialists who believe the profit motive is bad, and they all said so with respect to health insurance. They don't believe in the market economy. They believe in a government-directed existence. So this really frames whether or not we're going to continue to pursue those organizing principles which have allowed America to become the most innovative and wealthiest country the planet has ever seen, or if we're going to turn over the keys to our lives and livelihoods and possessions to septuagenarian socialists Bernie and Liz, or the socialist impersonators like Uncle Joe, or some such person like that. I mean, everything that was said over 5 hours between the 20 socialists over two nights, number one, the price tag is at least $1 trillion with a federal government that's $20 trillion in debt.
30.
Plus, approaching 30 plus another $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities. And the thing that was most interesting to me, they're having these debates in Detroit, which is just coming out of bankruptcy, lorded over by Democrats for generations, like most major urban centers, including the one in which we're speaking. And they're just so self-unaware that nobody even thinks to ask, much less address, hey, is Detroit a cautionary tale for central control, central planning and command control economies that mainly traffic in blank check promises? Is there anything to be taken away from what happened in Detroit and what was required to try to set Detroit back on a path of prosperity, like public sector pensioners and bondholders both taking a haircut? And it should be a cautionary tale for other local units of government and state governments that have localized the same central planning, the same socialist policies that these Democrat candidates for president are aiming to scale nationally.
As Dan Proft of WIND and his newspaper empire and political activism, and I, maybe Jeff too, start screaming at clouds, one thing I want to ask you, Dan, is that after all this study that you've done, the law school, reading Aristotle, all the hard books, C.S. Lewis, all the really hard books that you've spent your life studying, does it ever frost you that it really will, I guess, devolve into a battle of feelings, and that Kristen, whatever her real name is, Kristen Gillibrand, and her feelings and her woke suburban mom tour that you referenced earlier, It's all going to come down to that, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, look, I'm looking forward to the white suburban women of privilege Gillibrand goodwill tour, just like the next guy is, of course, coming to a suburban country club near you.
That'll be a bus tour because it's better for the environment.
Hate has no home here.
Yeah, right. Get your free hate has no home here. P-hat. I mean, she is the embodiment, this sort of chirpy cheerleader, is the embodiment of the sentimental barbarism of the left. Now, I think she's a bit of an impersonator with respect to that, but nonetheless, this is what she's parroting. And look, it just ends so badly. It just ends so badly. So it's frustrating, except to the extent that I know how this story ends, so I at least I can try to educate some, compel some to understand that this is going to end terribly for you, and the people you think are representing you are going to be the ones that are all too happy to feed you to the mobs that will come. Emotion as the basis of morality is a dead end. And you're seeing it play out in real time. I mean, you see it play out again and again in real time. Just when you think you're woke, you're not woke enough. That's the entire story of Joe Biden's candidacy. Joe Biden, who is as much a liberal lion of the Senate for the last 40 years as Ted Kennedy was, he was as left as you could be in the Democrat Party for four decades. And now they treat him like he's Ronald Reagan. So you can never be woke enough for the cultural Marxists, and you're not on board with three-year-olds calling their own shots with respect to gender, then you're going to have your professional career derailed. You're not on board with men competing in your daughter's sports, then your daughter is going to be ostracized in her schools and by her coaches. We see this happening again and again and again, and it all comes back to the same place. There's no truth. There's no standard of morality. My emotion is the basis of morality. And that sentimentality ultimately leads to violent ends committed by power mongers.
Can we take a moment to remember A.C. Slater as he was?
Yeah, I always figure you as a Slater guy.
Oh, yeah.
Carlin, I was definitely a Zach Attack guy because, you know, I was a pretty boy.
Right, and I was not. I was the, you know, I'd like to be bigger than I was.
Guys, I was actually working and making a living then.
Sorry, John.
Yeah.
Is this the show, the high school show?
Yeah.
That's where he was at,
right?
Yeah,
Saved by the Bell,
yeah.
And that Pee Wee Herman type guy that was...
Screech, yeah.
Screech,
yeah.
Right, yeah. I don't want to get
Screech.
Into that.
Screech. Yeah. Please, yeah, Screech.
Please let's leave him. When I wake up in the morning and the alarm gets out of warning, I don't think I'll ever make it on time. By the time I grab my books and I give myself a look, I'm at the corner just in time to see the bus fly by. It's all right.
So, Dan, can you define sentimental barbarism for those of us out there who aren't up to speed?
I asked him to ask you to define sentimental barbarism because, look, every time I do Dan's show, I ask him, and he's like, yeah, we'll get into it, and then he doesn't. And then I'm doing his show again, I think, in a week or so, and I'll ask him again, and he doesn't. So now you have time. There's no traffic at the sixes or whatever. You know, let me hear what is it?
The upshot of it is emotion is the basis of morality. I mean, if you really want a dissertation on it, much better than I can offer, read Flannery O'Connor's Mystery and Manners. And that goes for you two barbarians, not sentimental, just barbarians.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because, you know why? Because the truth doesn't change according to your ability to stomach it.
Well, that's right. And right. So there is such a thing as, absolute truth. There are such things as natural rights, but that's not what the sentimental barbarian, that's not how the sentimental barbarian views things. And so this goes back to this, you know, woke off, as Jay Nordlinger has described the two debates over the last two nights.
That's a perfect description for that whole CNN debacle with the pulling of the names and the weird openings and the
NFL playoffs. Nordlinger on Dan's show, the day that we're taping this, did talk about woke off, and he also had another good. He's the music critic for the New Criterion as well. As well as on the National Review, but he also said at one point I heard him say Biden in a competition of woker than thou will always lose because he's can't
yeah,
be woker
right.
than
thou. Well, that's right. So like Augustine said, Saint Augustine said that evil is the privation of good. So woke is the privation of reason, and that goes back to the sentimentality issue. You can't find morality in your emotion, and at the same time employ reason. The two run into conflict with one another, and then you have to make a choice. And you heard the choices that Democrat socialist presidential candidates are making. I mean, they spent an unbelievable time talking about It's remarkable, especially when their constituents mainly live in big urban centers, talking about who is more lenient when it comes to violent crime. Who's more committed to and has the better record of being limited, being lenient with convicted criminals. That's what they argued under the moniker of criminal justice reform before they turned their discussion to the border and talked about how people who commit crimes to come into this country or when they come into this country are also not criminals. And Tulsi Gabbard's formulation, we can't treat people here illegally like second-class citizens. I mean, the statements they make are so...
They're not citizens.
Conflicting. Right. They're so, that's the whole point. They're so self-conflicting, but they're oblivious to it, or whether purposefully or inadvertently, because it doesn't matter. It's all just, you know, children in cages. What's my position on immigration policy? I'm against children in cages. That's the extent of their policy position on the topic.
We don't want people becoming criminals by coming over the border illegally, so let's not make it illegal to come over the border.
Exactly. Problem solved.
Ta-da!
Beto O'Rourke on Wednesday night, Bobby, as he's better known when he's not running for office, Bobby addressed people in this country illegally in absentia as my fellow Americans. I mean, you know,
jumbo shrimp.
This is one of those things where conversations with socialists are impossible, because if you can't agree on any baseline, like 2 + 2 = 4, then how do you have a discussion about math?
Anybody who has any doubt about what happens when they take over, I just want you to look at Greece, okay? I know it's a nice place to go, and I love it. It's my ancestral homeland.
Yeah.
But all the guys who fought the communists left after they thought they defeated them and came to America to try to make money and risked everything to do so. And the communists came back in, took over the country. They call themselves socialists. It's the same thing. And it's basically a bleep show, okay, economically. And it's obvious. And if you say anything, if you dare say anything, they would call you a fascist. They would call you a capitalist. The same kind of thing I see here, where if you, even amongst themselves, the only grown-up in the debates for two nights was, what's his name?
John Delaney.
John Delaney.
Yeah, the former congressman, former from Maryland congressman. And trade rep,
Out of Maryland.
Well,
he was the only
adult. I mean, they're debating whether or not Joe Biden is a racist. They're debating whether or not Nancy Pelosi is a racist.
Here we come.
I mean, right? So,
yeah. Go on.
They're painting over murals in San Francisco of George Washington and a school name for George Washington. That's who they are.
We're at the point now where I saw two rhetorical tricks that they were used. One is, if for those on the, they're all on the left, by the way, I don't like this. There's the moderate centrist position in the left. No, even the centrists are far to the left. Okay. They would be way far to the left of a centrist like Kennedy. Kennedy would not even be allowed to be in this party. I'm talking about
his, that's right.
John. There's two things that they do. They did. One is, if you question me, then you're using Republican talking points.
Yeah, right.
And that's supposed to shut people down. The second formulation is the long-term strategy based on and on your Christian Gillibrand suburban mommy tour. When Mueller fell apart and that thing, that whole Russian collusion fantasy fell apart. They have another one, and it's Trump is a racist, and therefore, if you don't oppose him, you too are a racist, and the mob will devour you. I wonder how that's going to play out.
Well, I mean, it seems clear to me that there have been exactly zero lessons learned from 2016. They're basically, and Republicans have done this before too, much to their detriment. They're basically saying the only problem we had in 2016 is we had a fatally flawed candidate in Hillary Clinton. We can still say that Trump voters are deplorables. We can still deride the Trump voter. We can run around indulging in our wildest fantasies, embarrassing ourselves, staying silent in the face of thuggery, reporter being beaten on the streets in Portland. We can do all that because the only problem we had in 16 was a bad candidate. We're going to have a true believer, a fellow traveler in 2020, and we're going to defeat Trump, and then we're going to make our wildest utopian dreams come true. And that's the deindustrialization of America through the Green New Deal. I mean, the talk again yesterday about the elimination of fossil fuels and everybody competing to see who's going to do it the fastest arbitrarily. Bernie Sanders on Wednesday night basically rolling out these sort of Stalinist five-year plans and saying the only problem with Stalin, it took Stalin 5 years. I'm going to do it in four. Okay. All right. But that's where they're at. They've learned nothing from the last election. That's clear to me. They just think that if they talk to enough suburban women in Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania with somebody that is giving away all that free stuff they want to give away, and taxing the hell out of the rich is in the Bill de Blasio fashion, then that's going to be enough in 20. That's what they think.
The use of race, if I could get back to that. The lesson, as you pointed out, that they did not learn last time, it was you're a bunch of deplorables, and that hurt Hillary Clinton. Now it's you're a racist. Once you paint someone as a racist, and by the definition, their own definition, someone who should be hurt, someone who should be destroyed, and by extension, their voters. You don't give people anywhere else to go. And whether you win or lose an election, you are doing something dangerous in terms of the long-term health of the republic. When you subjugate a people, force them to their knees, just like African Americans were subjugated in the early 60s in the ghettos politically. The same thing could happen again on the other side. And I don't think that's really, I think that's a, you know, the canary in the coal mine thing. That's one right there.
Well, this is the Alinsky tactic, right? Personalize and demonize. That's how you move a flag, even in the face of majority opposition. So that's why those cultural Marxists of whom we speak, starting with the socialist Spice Girls, that's why they're not afraid to talk about the deindustrializing America. That's not why they're afraid. That's why they're not afraid to be openly and virulently anti-Semitic, demonize and personalize, then demonize. And by the way, that's not reserved for household names. That's not reserved for celebrities. That's not reserved for athletes. It's not reserved for Republican politicians. That can happen in your company. It can happen in your school district. It can happen in a social service organization, because the one thing they understand from their philosophical forerunners is politics needs to dominate every aspect of a person's life. And I'm not asking for that to come to be. Bernie Sanders had this, you know, talking, got all riled up, you know, right after he had this, like, get off my lawn moment with Tim Ryan, and I wrote the damn bill. He basically said, look, with respect to eliminating private health insurance, there's no choice. And that was sort of an excited utterance, almost Freudian by Bernie, because that's the, in three words, that sums up his entire campaign and the mantra of the real mantra of the Democrat Socialist Party. There's no choice. And that includes forcing politics into every single crevice of your life. So you best be prepared for it. Now, the racism thing, yeah, it's going to sort of start to become the boy who cried wolf. It's going to lose meaning through overuse and misapplication. But it doesn't mean that those other sentimental barbarians that are allies of the political class and their D.C. press corps handmaidens won't nevertheless impose discipline in the sectors over which they lord. That's the problem. You have these people that are in control, effectively, of all of the civic and so many of the social organizations in this country, and that's a huge problem. That's a real problem, and it scares people, so they keep quiet, except when they can express themselves at the ballot box, which has happened, which happened in 2016, and I think is going to happen again in 2020. You want to call me a racist and all these things. I'm just going to sit here and take, and I'm going to be quiet. I don't need to fight everywhere I turn and every walk of life that I experience. But, you know, just wait when it comes down to a choice. And I think that's something that Trump has going for him. And I think that includes among black and brown people as they're being dehumanized in reference by these Marxists, people of color, dehumanizing rhetoric. But okay, those are the terms they use. You know, the Ayanna Pressley, Frances Parker Spice, educated at Tony Frances Parker in Chicago, her statement a couple of weeks ago at that Netroots conference that you are essentially not authentically a black person or a brown person if you don't agree with us. Well, that's a real message sender. It tells you that race is not what they're really interested in. They're not interested in racial justice. They're interested in power, and they can't sell cultural Marxism on its merits, so they have to sell cultural Marxism by saying we're in the business of racial justice.
He is Dan Proft. You can hear him every day on WIND, and Dan and I, I think, are the last conservatives left in this town, right?
I'm going to leave it to one of you two to turn out the lights.
Well, I'm going to turn out the lights, baby, because I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to Naples to tarpon fish. Although, if you invite me, I'll definitely come.
Okay, you're a standing invitation.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. Dan Proft.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
And now we're talking to my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, Jason Meisner, the federal building reporter, who had a great story this week. Politically connected ex-Teamster boss pleads guilty to extorting Chicago film studio, agrees to cooperate. And Jason Meisner, after that, I tweeted out your story, and I put a little advice to Mr. Coley, if you're asked to go to Chinatown for spaghetti dinner at midnight, don't go.
Right.
So, sound advice.
So, you know, because sometimes you might get a call from a guy who wants, hey, you want to come out for...
Right. I thought they closed at 11. No, they'll be just real nice.
We got it all ready for you. There's Visqueen on the floor when you come in, and it's dark room.
It'll be in his territory. He'll take care of everything.
It's perfect for our purposes. What do you make of it? And tell us about the story and what happened.
John Coley, a longtime Teamsters boss here in Chicago, but also nationally. He was a national figure in this union, which obviously is one of the most powerful unions in the country. He pled guilty, which was expected. It was on the docket. We knew he was going to plead guilty, but what we didn't know, he pled guilty to an extortion plot where he was extorting the president of the film studio, CineSpace, for $25,000 in cash every quarter, to the tune of what was supposed to be $400,000-something, and then he was going to retire. But he got caught. The studio head, Alex Pisios, wore a wire for the FBI, and he got caught. So he pled guilty to two charges, and what we learned this week was that he's cooperating, and that was the bombshell.
You had the story about a month ago that he was indicted and may cooperate. So you were ahead of the game there, but of course, that's why people read the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, they played this one close to the vest. We didn't know for sure, but that's what everybody was wondering, trying to read the tea leaves. Is he cooperating? Because a guy like Coley, as you know, knows a lot of things. He's rubbed elbows with the most powerful politicians in the state, lavished money on them, been appointed to state boards, and just is he was one of Rahm Emanuel's biggest supporters when Rahm had no union support early on, and his endorsement, Teamster's endorsement, was key for Rahm Emanuel. So Mike Madigan, you name it, for Governor Quinn, Governor Rauner, all of these guys dealt with John Coley on multiple occasions, not just from afar. So if he's cooperating, we'll see. We don't know. They said they used the word investigations, which I found interesting. He's cooperating in investigations, and he will get a big break on his sentence if he gives the feds what they want, which is truthful testimony in any trial, any criminal proceeding, grand jury, or any civil proceeding going forward. So he has no sentencing date because everything is contingent upon him cooperating with the Fed.
The Chicago office of the FBI and their corruption squad, run by these, I don't know, I get hockey playing, Irish Catholic warrior priests of the FBI, guys who were former prosecutors, they just know the game and they know who the players are. When they get a fish like Coley, man, I think they landed the tuna, no?
Hey, that's
I see what you're
yeah,
doing.
Yeah,
nice doing a Burke.
Segue into the Burke case, which is also being investigated by these guys. The land the tuna is, I think when Mark Brown and the Sun-Times had a column saying, you know, this is as significant as any alderman really cooperating, or maybe more significant, because, first of all, it's rare to flip a guy like Coley, who famously, I put this in my story, he once had in a sworn deposition, he was being sued for alleged mob ties and in the union, and lawyer asked him a question, and he said, just for the record, go ask yourself, and that was taken down by, I can only imagine the court reporter taking this down, and then the lawyer said, so I'll take that to no, and he said, I think my answer speaks for itself.
When he said, F yourself, he didn't use air quotes when he was sitting in the deposition, did he?
No, and I only wish we had audio of it, because right. This guy has a deep baritone voice. He's telling this guy to F off, and that's the kind of guy he is, so it's surprising a little bit that they were able to flip him, and obviously he's 59 years old, so he's thinking he was probably threatened with, you know, you're going to do 10 years in prison. That's maybe the most the rest of his life. So he's hoping for a big break. He could get as little as a year and a half if he cooperates. So I think that's how they did it. And we won't know for a while what his sentence is. It may come out months to come what exactly he's cooperating on. But
or years.
One can imagine. We know that as part of this investigation, they subpoenaed recently State Senator Tom Cullerton's expense records, and he's a longtime Teamster guy, and so we know that it's branched out. It started as this extortion plot. It's branched out to state government and other areas, so we'll see what happens going forward.
Well, the reason why people come to the Chicago Way and read your stories and read my column is because we go to what we know, and without asking you to speculate, I'm just going to lay this out. The CineSpace deal. On the West Side, where I think they taped Kim Fox's favorite singer and dancer.
The Empire.
Empire, yeah, right? Jussie Smollett and others, right?
It's the small world. Yeah, small the whole world. Jussie Smollett thing mm-hmm. unfolded, beginning at Empire.
So they have that. They have a lot of political clout. Alex Pisios, yeah, he's, I guess, of my tribe. His uncle was the tough guy from Toronto who knew tough guys. And the uncle comes to Chicago. He wants to start a movie studio. You know, and people said, I think it was the Sun-Times that said, Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley, the real one, didn't like the movie studios here in Chicago because back in the day, he didn't like the image that they brought. Here's the deal on that. There was a guy named DeLucia, Paul DeLucia, also known as Paul the Waiter Rica. He ran the Chicago outfit for years. I mean, he ran the entire outfit in the entire country. For years, basically from the time he came to Chicago till the time he took his last breath. He's the one who wanted the movies in Hollywood because they had Korshak there and other powerful guys there, and they cleaned that town up let's put it this way, they cleaned the rackets out of that town because they had their own racket. It was called Making Movies. Anybody who screwed up back there would end up like at Mulholland Falls. They had the cops who took care of the problems for them. Let's fast forward to many, many years later. Now Alex Picios, the uncle, wants to bring the movie studio to Chicago. So I think he goes to a bank. And I think that bank is run by politically connected people, Jason Meisner. And this bank has guys who know guys. And they get a grant of how many millions of dollars to open a studio from the state through Pat Quinn.
Belmont Bank, run by some names that you often see in your column.
And that you and I have reported on. And one of them's named right. Freddie, okay? And another Jimmy. And so once they get the grant and everything, and before Coley gets indicted, you know what happens? The guys on the bank pull themselves off the board. They're not on the board anymore. And then the indictment happens. And I got some questions. I got my Chris Matthews tingling up my leg now. Not Chris himself, but that feeling.
The feeling most people get when they hear a Barack Obama speech. I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
Steady.
No, seriously. It's a dramatic event.
Are you ready for a new sensation?
I got a feeling that this, if they're going to do an investigation, they might want to look at the bank. They might want to look at Governor Quinn and the grant money and who were the state legislators, if any, how you doing, who helped facilitate that. Or as I said to someone in the know in the federal system, and if you don't go there, then I know who your snitches are. This is exactly the kind of thing Jason and I did for years when we worked together at the... He often played that role that I just did. We just kick things around. So where do you see that going?
Follow the money is what they do. But oftentimes they need to get a criminal charge. It's okay to follow the money, but oftentimes you need that person who's inside to testify under oath and say, yes, this was the arrangement. This was the quid pro quo. That's what they need. And that's what a guy like Coley can provide, if he's providing it. I have no idea. But, yeah, you need the money, and then you needed somebody to tell you, put all the pieces of the puzzle together for this jury or for the grand jury, and then you have your charges. So there are some powerful people who are involved in getting this studio its money, and it's always been politically connected and politically charged. The guy that Coley was allegedly trying to have fired or said should be fired for daring to question why are we paying extortion money to this union guy. That guy, the CFO of Cinespace, is married to the new Cook County commissioner, Bridget Degnan. And he used to work for Ryerson Steel, which is the land that the studio is now on, that they had to clean up because it was polluted. These connections go way back.
Can I throw one in too? It's just like serendipity, you know, the Chicago way serendipity, as we say. The guy, now that fellow, what's his name, the commissioner? Or the woman, his wife, right? She had right. union backing. She defeated another Cook County board member who just happened to be named John Fritchie, whose
right.
father-in-law, former father-in-law, was none other than the 36 Wards boss, Sam Pastries Banks. And Sam Pastries Banks really didn't eat pastries, and he used to go around town saying, why the bleep is Cass always saying I'm pastries? I hate bleeping pastries. But it wasn't about the pastries. It was just about the cannoli. You know what I mean, Sam? But Sam's dead now.
The name Banks was not the original family name, if I remember correctly.
Very good, Mr. Meisner. It was a former alderman, Billy Whitebread's, or Panabianco, as we say. And as a baker, I wonder if Jeff Carlin understands Pana Bianco is white bread.
Pana Bianco.
Yeah, that one translates thoroughly. I love this stuff. This is my favorite. This is why we just wanted to do the Chicago ways, these step stones, walkthroughs of Chicago history. But now I'm peering inside John's head, and I'm going to hypothesize here, and I don't want to pull Jason into it too much, but I see this web, you know, you always see in the movies where they have like the one photo and all the strings tied out to all these little things. So now we see the Empire connection, but now we see the connection from between Empire, the studios, and then to Rahm, to possibly
Quinn and others. Yeah.
Right, right. But I'm trying pulling this back to just Jussie Smollett, because I'm just saying, I'm watching this tangled web on Weave. Is there, there could be a possibility that power was moved that way to maybe somehow influence that, because Rahm's not friends with the state's attorney, Kim Fox. So they still need a conduit to her, but Rahm could know somebody who knows somebody who's connected to Kim Fox. So now we have a whole wide web of things that may or may not be a possibility, but I'm just hypothetically looking at John's head. I see these strings starting to reach out and right. tie together.
It's a rabbit hole. You start going down it, I tell you, and then he's connected to this guy, and this guy is married to this woman, and you start to wonder. Of course, the CineSpace studio is where the Smollett letter, the original thing, this is what sparked everything. He gets this letter, allegedly sent anonymously to him at the studio in January, and it's got the MAGA stuff and threats and gay slurs on it. And the story from police is he was just upset that this didn't cause more of a stir. They never quite said it, but they insinuated that he sent the letter to himself. That's being investigated by the FBI.
Bingo.
Haven't heard much about that since, you know, now that's all embroiled in the special prosecutor being appointed in Cook County to reinvestigate the Smollett case. So we don't know. That's kind of on a back burner. But the FBI has that letter, and last I heard, they were analyzing it for fingerprints and DNA and whoever licked the stamp or whatever. But that's all. It's all tied together.
Yeah, Jason, as my Neapolitan barber and soccer expert Rafael Rea often says, silence is the consent. Silence is the story. He's a conspiratorial mind, as a Neapolitan that he is. I have to ask you.
You can't catch a fish if it doesn't open its mouth.
All right, tell everybody where we heard that. You have to tell the story.
That was at the old Italian-American club, and the guy's name is going to escape me, but you know it, the guy who's run it.
DeFaggio, Captain D.
Captain D.
Who often was seen with Tommy Lasorda and a guy named Ray Joe on WGN when they would show Tommy Lasorda at the... There's Tommy Lasorda! He's watching the game! And there he was with Captain D.
The quick story is that that was after the news had come out that the Hook, Angelo the Hook LaPietra's house had been targeted for burglary by these guys, these mob guys, and we went down there to check it out. We brought the cannoli, left the box, nobody answered the door at his, like, block, one square block mansion in Bridgeport. So we left the box there, and then we went to the old Italian-American club down the street. And I think, and this is not, I'm not joking, we asked for Captain D, and they literally said he's playing pinochle in the back or something like
Bingo.
That.
Bingo. Yes, they did. And they were also like, talking about being like, if you're bald, you have to eat chicken. Something like, if you eat chicken, you're going to go bald.
Oh, these old guys, were talking about it. Some news story that was out about if you eat too much chicken, you go bald. And they were laughing. And then Captain D came out, and we asked him about Angelo the Hook. And that's when he said his now famous line, "You can't catch a fish if he doesn't open his mouth."
Because I think there was a fish on the wall of the club that Angelo the Hook LaPietra built.
Yeah, he pointed to it, and then he said he wouldn't say anything, and we said no kind, and then he pointed to it, said that line.
I have another question for you. I brought this up on in private communication, but I have to ask this, and I'm not asking you to confirm or deny, but just so other people, our listeners know, because this is the Chicago way. The thing that I don't get is that historically, and if you go back in time in some of the people associated in this whole business, you'll see, like, you won't see a Paul the Waiter Rica thing, but you will see wise guys in and out. How does a Teamster shake down an industry that is known to have wise guys around it, maybe even sitting next to this chubby Greek guy, Pisios, for months and months? Not that anyone would be sitting down there, but if there was, and his name was Jimmy I'd have a question. How do you shake somebody down with those guys around? How does that work?
I don't know. But reportedly, this whole deal started under his uncle, Theseus's uncle, and he was just continuing. After the uncle died, he was continuing to pay these extortion payments. So whatever the arrangement is, would be interesting to find out. I hope we do find out. Maybe at Mr. Coley's sentencing someday.
I also, Jason, want to find out how, you know, the politics of the I don't know how many, what was, I don't even know what the number of the grant was, but it was gigantic, a state grant. You know, it was one of those Pat Quinn press conferences, like, and we are going to produce movies, and you have the fire, Chicago Fire Department soap opera, Chicago Police soap operas, all these soap operas that are not, so they're not at, they're at night, but whatever they are, I never watched them. But you have all
that's
these,
one of the biggest studios in the country.
Right, and so how does, so the politics of it is interesting. Mr. Cullerton, the state, what is he, state rep or state senator, who is cousins with, I think his cousin is the state senate president, right? Johnny Cullerton? Mm-hmm. Just another serendipity, Chicago Way serendipity. 6 degrees of separation. How you doing? What do you know? And this guy, did he get the grant? Is he one of the people that are lined up to take the heat for the grant? Cullerton, because didn't he go to Italy with a bunch in your story? Please read it. Please read it. Go find it. It's on Google.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Jason has a paragraph in there about some guys going to Italy. What was that?
In the guilty plea, Coley admitted to, in addition to this extortion plot, $400,000, whatever it was, he received almost $500,000 in perks that he's supposed to report to the, you know, union regulators, but he never did. And among them were fine dining restaurants, Las Vegas trips. He had a couple tickets to Major League Baseball, NFL, and then, which I found very nice, was a yacht, use of a yacht with a crew for him and his family to take trips. And one of the trips was a cruise around Italy, in and around Italy was the quote. So that was part of the guilty plea, $500,000 worth of perks.
All right, so where does this go from here?
That will be interesting to see, because we now have, you can count, you need more than one hand to now count the number of public corruption investigations going on at one time. I wasn't around in the days of, Gambit and what was the other big one, Greylord, but this has got to be up there. We now have unions, we have movie studios, we have Mike Madigan, his friends, Ed Burke, Danny Solis, state senators, and it's all kind of simmering under the surface. The only thing that's been public is this Coley case and the Burke case.
And and the bank in Bridgeport.
The Sun-Times has been reporting on.
Yeah. But you know it, right?
Kinky deal down there.
The guy commits suicide.
Guy hangs himself.
Boat's missing.
Yeah.
All that's happening. All that's happening. And right, and Coley erupts publicly, but a lot of this is private or quiet. One of the, you brought up Operation Greylord, which was the investigation, indictments, and convictions of many judges, particularly in traffic court and chancery court, for taking bribes. But you get indicted in that kind of case, you're going to prison. But there's one guy who walked. He was acquitted. You know that? Jason?
Just one guy. Just guy one who had like tens of thousands of dollars of cash in his freezer.
Freezing, yeah.
Even though he was a bailiff.
Yeah, he was a bailiff making, I don't know.
Traffic court bailiff.
$12,000 a year driving, I think, a Stingray and a Jaguar. Or something like that. Had two amazing cars. And he smells of cologne to this day. Former state senator named Jimmy. Now he's the king of Rosemont, I hear. But he was not convicted. He walked, but everyone else went down. So I don't know how this is going to go. But I think you're right, Jason. On the wall at the Angelo La Pietra, the Hook Social Club that was built there on 31st Street in Bridgeport, is a bass. And when you ask people questions, they point to it and say you can't catch a fish if it don't open its mouth. So we'll see. Jason Meissner,
yep.
Thanks for being here, man.
Thanks for having me on. Talk to you later.
See you, buddy. For Jason Meissner, my former leg man and federal building reporter for the Chicago Tribune on that great John Coley investigation. And for Dan Proft, WIND morning host, conservative, one of the last few conservatives left in this town. Actually, I know there's like three of us, okay? And one's a woman named Kristen. And for Jeff Carlin, WGN's executive producer of the Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, man without a garden, man with Zeus, columnist for the Chicago Tribune and member of its editorial board. Find us wherever you can find us. Write great reviews on iTunes. Keep it going because we're growing and you're helping us and we love you for it. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.